This is Main Street on Prairie Public. And we call our show Main Street because these microphones are our virtual Main Street across the state of North Dakota this time of day. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. And today we're going to actually stop at that Main Street and kind of ponder the heavens with somebody who's a renowned expert. Andrew Fracknoy joins us by phone from San Francisco. He's recently retired from Foothills College, where he was an astronomer and educator. Matter of fact, he was California's Carnegie Professor of the Year back in 2007, so his teaching credentials are wonderful. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure being with you.
We want to talk to you about the upcoming solar eclipse. This is happening on August 21st. They're calling it kind of the all-American eclipse. It's a coast-to-coast eclipse if you are in the path of totality from Oregon to South Carolina. Everywhere else, you get anywhere from, 40 to 80% coverage here. How big of a deal is this eclipse?
Well, this is the first United States eclipse of the Internet age, and we are both incredibly excited and really scared about what that's going to mean in terms of vast numbers of people suddenly deciding to go to the zone where the eclipse is total. So let's fill in your listeners a little bit about what's happening. It's a remarkable coincidence that, as seen from Earth, the moon and the sun just happen to be the same size. The moon is a lot closer, but it's smaller. The sun's a lot bigger, but it's a lot further away. And it just works out that they happen to be the same size in the sky. And that means the moon can get in front of the sun and completely cover it. And that's what happens during a total eclipse of the sun. This eclipse, as you say, will be visible from one country and one country only, and that's the United States. They're already calling it the all-American eclipse, and I'm sure the people in Washington will take full credit for it once they wake up to the fact that it's happening. But it is only visible, the total eclipse is only visible in this narrow path, which is 60 to 70 miles wide, as you guys said. And so if you're in that path, you see a total eclipse. If you're outside that narrow path, you see a pretty good partial eclipse where part of the sun is covered. And I looked it up in North Dakota. You guys are going to get a 92% coverage.
Wow.
92% of the sun will be covered up. That's a very spectacular partial eclipse. You still need to guard your eyes, even with that much of the sun covered. The part that's showing is dangerous to look at. So we'll talk later, I hope, about safe ways of observing the sun. But it should be quite a nice eclipse.
August 21st is the day it happens. What time will we have that nice partial eclipse in Fargo?
So in your case, it's going to start, the moon is going to start moving across the sun about 12:55 p.m. on that Monday, August 21st. And the most eclipse that the sun will get will be around 2:21 p.m. So starting about 2 or 2:15 is the time to come outside from work and make sure you're looking at the sun. And then the partial eclipse will end at about 3:45 p.m.
Will this be a very dark sky? Will it look like a major thunderstorm has moved into the area?
Yeah, it won't be as dark as during the total eclipse, but it will look like there's major cloud cover. You know, when the sun is covered by clouds, it does get darker, and with a 92% eclipse, you'll definitely notice that it'll be a slightly darker sky.
What happens, I'm sure side effects is not really the right term to use here, but I have heard stories of animals behaving somewhat erratically. Birds suddenly stop chirping. Cows might start heading towards the barn. What are some of those things that might happen during an eclipse?
Well, that's exactly right. Even people get pretty confused because during a total eclipse, it's absolutely spectacular. The moon covers the sun, and the sun literally goes out. So it's nighttime during the day. Some of the bright stars become visible, but it's only nighttime in that shadow spot. So if you have a good view toward the horizon, you will see parts of the world which are still bright, and then you're in a place where it's pretty dark, and that's confusing for people as well as animals. So you're right, animals don't quite know what to do. Their stomach clock and what they're seeing don't agree. Is it nighttime really? What's going on? And so after the few minutes pass and the eclipse is over, then animals really look around like, whoa, what just happened?
How can we
people do too.
How can we safely view the eclipse?
Well, so this is what's sort of been very exciting as a project that I've been involved with, is that we managed to persuade a nonprofit foundation and the company Google to make available 2 million safe eclipse viewing glasses through public libraries nationwide. And so the first place that anyone who's interested in viewing the eclipse should go is their public library and ask the librarian, are you guys participating in the StarNet Libraries Eclipse Program? And if they are, then they will have eclipse glasses. These are paper-framed glasses, pretty much like what you used to get at the movies for 3D glasses, with a dark plastic insert in the eye part, which shields you from 90% of the rays of the sun and makes it safe to look at the sun. You need to look at the back of these glasses and make sure they say certified, that they meet the standards that the people who are eye doctors have set for us. And the ones you get in the United States do that. If your library doesn't carry them, then check out your local science museum. Many college bookstores will have these eclipse glasses. Some hardware stores, some Walmarts will have them. If you can't get them there, they're available on the web. Two companies make the safe certified eclipse glasses in the United States. One is called American Paper Optics, and the other one is called Rainbow Symphony. So you can check them out on the web. But that's the easiest, is to get these glasses, and they shouldn't cost you, if you buy them, more than about $2. They're perfectly safe. If you can't get them, another way to view the eclipse, the partial eclipse, is to use a colander. Now, this is something that most people don't think about, but the colander, which you wash your vegetables and fruit in, that's made up of a bunch of holes through which the water flows. If you take a colander and hold it over your shoulder with your back to the sun, and you see the shadow it makes on the pavement, that shadow through all the little holes will show you a lot of little images of the eclipse sun. Hmm. It's really quite beautiful when you look at that colander shadow on the sidewalk, and then when it gets too hot, you can put the colander over your head to shield your head from the rays of the sun.
Yeah, won't have to wear the tinfoil anymore.
That's right.
Where will the longest period of total eclipse be this time around on August 21st?
Well, this is a fun question. First of all, there's the bad news that as eclipses go, this total eclipse is really pretty short. Mm-hmm. Even in the longest place, it'll only be 2 minutes and 40 seconds. Often we can have 5-6 minute eclipses. Now, two cities are vying for the title of the best eclipse in the country: Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and Carbondale, Illinois. But they'll only have like 10 seconds more than other places, so it's not really that big a deal. But it's about a 2-2.5 minute eclipse.
Is it better to try to get up high, or do you just kind of need to be away from buildings, or does it really matter because as long as you can see the sun, it's okay?
That's right. This partial eclipse is very democratic. First of all, we calculate that between Canada, the United States, and Mexico, and then a little bit further south of Mexico too, 500 million people this time will be able to see the partial eclipse, some part of the sun covered. And that's a huge number of people. That's what made us tear our hair about how are we going to get eclipse glasses to all those people. but that also means that safety instructions are important for those people. But yes, all those people, all they need to do is to know where the sun is and look where the sun is. You don't need to get to a particularly high location. What I would do is on Sunday, August 20th, I would go to where I expect to be around 2 p.m. on the 21st, on Monday, and check out, is the sun visible? If you're in a downtown area, maybe buildings will block your view. If you're in a place where there are a lot of tall trees, maybe trees will make it difficult. So the day before, check out your location, your expected location, and figure out where you can see the sun, and then check out the sun that next day on Monday, and just make sure you have glasses or some other safe way of viewing things. Maybe I should mention one other safe way of viewing, which is to use a hand mirror or a woman's compact mirror. again, practice this the weekend before, but cover most of the mirror with a piece of cardboard, leaving a hole only about the size of a dime. And you can then use that hand mirror to reflect an image of the sun onto a wall. Now, this requires some practice, so I would do this the day before. But if you can make an image of the sun reflect from the sun onto a wall, particularly a white wall, then when the eclipse comes, you'll actually see the sun with increasing bites taken out of it, and you'll be the hero of whoever's around you because you've got a way of projecting a safe image.
Does the eclipse still offer any scientific research opportunities?
Well, now here's the exciting part for scientists. When the eclipse is total, the other thing that happens in the sky that I didn't mention is that the moon covers the bright face of the sun completely, and the faint atmosphere of the sun comes out. We never see that faint atmosphere because the sun is so bright. But during an eclipse, we can watch that faint atmosphere. A lot of action happens in that faint atmosphere of the sun. Great tongues of material fly off the sun. The sun is highly magnetic, and magnetic energy heats that faint atmosphere and makes it dance around. That whole atmosphere was discovered during eclipses, and we still, during each eclipse, follow what's happening in that faint atmosphere. In fact, this time around, Google and the University of California at Berkeley have a project called the Eclipse Mega Movie, where they're going to ask photographers in the zone to take pictures of the atmosphere of the sun during the total eclipse and wirelessly send it to Google. And then Google is going to stitch all the pictures from the entire country together into what they call a mega movie. And they promise, let's see if they can do it, that by the evening of August 21st, they will have up on the web the hour and 30 minutes of the United States eclipse with everybody's photographs stitched together time in the right time sequence to show a kind of movie of how the atmosphere of the sun changes during our eclipse.
Wow. Talk about really taking advantage of the first total eclipse of the internet age here.
Yes.
Where will astronomer Andrew Fracknoy be on August 21st?
Well, in an undisclosed location in Oregon. We have a small group of us who are going up to Oregon, and we have a place where very kindly a local community has given us a space, but they don't want to advertise that. So we will be in Central Oregon, and that leads to, I think, the more general question of if you have a choice, if you have time on that day to go up into the zone, where should you go? And the number one question I would ask myself is, what will the weather likely be in the location I'm going to go to? Because there's nothing worse than being in the right place for an eclipse and having complete cloud cover. So please, if you're going to the eclipse zone or you're planning for the eclipse, pay attention to weather reports. There's a meteorologist whose name is Jay Anderson, who has a website called Eclipsophile, and he keeps track of eclipse weather all over the world, and he's been making predictions for the August 21 eclipse about where it will be better. And it is true that the further west you are in the United States, the more likely we are to have clear skies on August 21st.
You are a public astronomer, which means to me that at any rate that you are good at communicating this stuff that is can be pretty complicated. You've also written a book for kids about this, When the Sun Goes Dark. Tell us about that.
Well, that's right. So we looked around, and there wasn't really a good book explaining eclipses to kids. And so my partner Dennis Schatz and I wrote a book called When the Sun Goes Dark, which is published by the National Science Teachers Association. It's a picture book for kids. It tells the story of grandparents who are eclipse chasers, who have as a hobby going to see as many eclipses as they can, and they're explaining to the grandkids why they're so excited. And as part of that story, we suggest some very simple home activities that families can do, maybe with a light bulb and a tennis ball and the kid's head, to simulate eclipses, to explain why they're so rare. And that way, when kids come August 21st, either to school or with their families to appreciate the eclipse, they'll know a little bit more about what's happening. They'll be the eclipse experts of their neighborhood. So I hope that those who have kids or grandparents might look up this book, When the Sun Goes Dark. It's available on Amazon, and it's available from the National Science Teachers Association.
Well, as the saying goes, you are supposed to write what you know. Is there some background here? Did you grow up in a family of eclipse chasers?
Actually, no. My family was completely mystified when I became an astronomer. We do know how it happened, which is that I wasn't born in this country. I was born in Hungary. And when we came to America, I was 11, and I didn't speak a word of English. And my mom had this great idea of teaching me English through comic books. And, you know, a lot of the comic books back in the late 1950s, early 1960s were about outer space.
Yes.
Superman came from outer space. Green Lantern went into outer space. And so I started reading outer space comic books and just got fascinated and then discovered that you could actually do this as a living, which was a wonderful realization.
Well, I went on YouTube, and you're all over YouTube explaining all kinds of astronomical phenomenon. And one thing that I think is always intriguing to humans who hear about it is that we are the stuff that stars are made of. We might have pieces of us that are many billions of years old.
That's right. It's one of the most amazing discoveries of astronomy in the last century, that we now know that the atoms that make up our bodies, the carbon, the iron in your blood, the calcium in your bones, those atoms didn't exist when the universe began. They had to be made in the universe, and the place where they're made is deep inside stars, where nuclear reactions convert simpler elements to more complicated ones. And then some stars at the end of their lives have the courtesy to explode. They just blow up. And then they recycle the elements that they've made deep inside them into space so that when new generations of stars and planets form, they incorporate these heavier elements. And we, the sun and the earth and all your listeners, are what we call third generation material in the cosmos. Two previous generations of stars have lived and died in this neighborhood of the cosmos. And so we've inherited the elements that were made in previous generations of stars. And so depending on whether you're a romantic or a cynic, you can say we are all made of stardust, or you could say we are all the recycled garbage of stars that have died. But either way, it's a pretty amazing thought.
Well, and some of us have asteroids named after us. Well, just you. Tell us about asteroid 4859.
That was a great honor that I received. Asteroids that we've discovered, thousands of asteroids, and they need names. And so the discoverers, the astronomers who discover them, have the privilege of naming them, and sometimes they name them after colleagues. And it's pretty rare for someone who works in education, as I do, to have an asteroid named after them. Usually it's for, you know, major research astronomy discoveries. But I was very honored a discoverer at the Lowell Observatory decided to name this asteroid after me for my educational work.
Well, you've also been involved for a long time with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI. Update us. Has progress been made?
Well, this is one of the most exciting parts of astronomy. We believe that out there among the stars, there are not only many planets, we know that now, that thousands of planets have been discovered around other stars, some of them actually quite similar to the Earth. But in addition, we think there's been enough time on all those planets, and the things that happen on Earth that lead to life are not that unusual or difficult. So we believe that out there might be many planets that have life on them, and maybe even some where life has evolved to be intelligent enough to have radio talk shows. And so we would love to talk to some of these alien civilizations, at least to know that they're there, to exchange signals with them. And that's what SETI's all about. There's a huge number of stars, and we don't know what channel they might be broadcasting on or how their messages are coded. So it's an enormous, we call it the cosmic haystack problem. It's like trying to find a needle in a haystack. But as you may have heard, a Russian multi-billionaire has given $100 million to the University of California at Berkeley recently to put energy and resources behind this search. And we at the SETI Institute, where I'm on the board, are also really engaged in a number of projects, including looking for laser signals from aliens. And so we are more optimistic than ever that maybe one of these days, one of these experiments will reveal the presence of intelligence out there among the stars.
In a current lifetime, in the 21st century?
Well, we don't know. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. You don't know when you're going to find it. Now we have equipment that can search more than a million channels at the same time. Imagine if you could do that at home, go through your TV and see if anything good is on in a million channels all at once. So we're searching a lot of channels. We're searching a lot of stars. We're searching different kinds of waves. We're looking if they're making laser signals. We're trying to find heat from giant structures out there among the stars. We're looking for radio waves, which is how we communicate with our listeners. So we're trying everything we can, and no one knows whether this will pay off tomorrow or in a couple of hundred years.
You and I grew up when space exploration was huge. We last landed on the moon in like 1972. That's more than 40 years ago. When you were teaching students at Foothills College, were you seeing an increase in interest among students for astronomy and physics, you know, these difficult sciences that are so intriguing when you talk about the stuff we've been talking about?
Well, I think, you know, there is still a lot of interest, and these days it's not so much human exploration, but the exploration of the planets that our robot representatives are doing that catches people's eye. There's a spacecraft called Cassini, which is right now sending back some amazing pictures from Saturn, the rings of Saturn. There's a moon around Saturn that has geysers of saltwater steam coming out of it. So I think some of these discoveries are still fascinating kids and getting them interested. The other thing is science fiction movies. I find a lot of students took my astronomy class because they saw some film that was really interesting, something like Gravity or this recent movie called Arrival, which I thought was a beautiful movie about making contact with aliens. And then kids want to find out, well, what's the real story behind what we see in the movies? And that's what an astronomy class can do for you.
This All-American Eclipse is coming up again August 21st. Do you remember your very first eclipse?
Well, I do. I have to confess that the first total eclipse that I saw was not until 1991. I was a poor student and then a poor teacher, so I couldn't go to where the rich people went all around the world to see the eclipses. But the eclipse that's coming up, I just want to mention to your listeners, if you want to find out more about what's visible where and safe ways to observe it, we did put a free booklet up on the web. And your listeners can find it pretty easily if you just go to NSTA. NSTA stands for National Science Teachers Association. NSTA.org/solar science. One word, solar science. That's where a page from which you can link directly to an 8-page free booklet that the teachers' organization is making available. And you can send that booklet to your friends and relatives around the country and give them the times and the information about the eclipse and then these ways of safe viewing that we've been talking about.
Well, Andrew Fracknoy, we know what we'll be doing August 21st. Thank you for sharing your information with our listeners today.
My pleasure, and I wish you and your listeners clear skies that Monday, August 21st.
Andrew Fracknoy, astronomer and educator. Coming up on Main Street, a conversation with Grand Forks native Tom Brosseau, who's bringing a new music show to Medora. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The acting state director of the North Dakota Farm Service Agency says there has been a sharp increase of activity in FSA offices around the state due to the summer drought. Brian Haugen says now that Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue has authorized emergency haying on conservation reserve land, FSA staff members on the county level have been busy.
When the secretary made the announcement to authorize emergency haying was right when we were into our final week of crop acreage reporting for crop year 2017. So the counties were hit with both finalizing those along with handling requests for emergency haying of CRP.
Haugen says a federal hiring freeze has meant new staff cannot be brought on board to help handle the demand of applications. He says under the secretary's order, once a producer has completed the application, they could begin haying immediately. As far as the demand by producers?
The secretary's announcement was like at 3:30 on Thursday, July 20th, and we had a report out of one county that 8 o'clock the next morning we had over 30 producers standing, you know, ready to visit with county office staff on processing a request for emergency haying.
Haugen says a complete tally of how many acres are being requested for emergency haying is not available. He says the increased activity is not expected to slow down anytime soon. Haugen says federal assistance for water hauling and a livestock forage program will be opening soon. The Grand Forks School District is one step closer to inking a new one-year contract with teachers. The teachers ratified the deal on Monday. The school board will discuss the proposed contract tomorrow night. The package calls for teachers to receive scheduled step increases in salary. The two sides also pledged to study issues surrounding maternity leave and prep time. The North Dakota Fact-Finding Commission was brought in when the two sides declared an impasse in talks back in May. And it's the end of an era for Sanford Medical Center in Fargo. Sanford's new nearly half-billion-dollar hospital officially opened this morning. Chief Operating Officer Nate White says the first patients began arriving at the new location at 5 a.m.
We've had concerts and press conferences and ribbon cuttings and groundbreakings and, you know, sort of all the activities you could imagine, but it was all for today, you know, to see the first patient. And I think you sort of realize the magnitude of the jobs that our staff does and the meaning that this project has to the community when the first patient walks through the door.
White says because of extensive planning, everything at the new hospital is working as smoothly as it possibly could. The new hospital has 284 private beds with room for expansion to 380. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. And on the phone, Tom Brousseau. He's in Salt Lake City where he lives now, but he's a Grand Forks native and musician, and he's coming back our way. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Thank you for having me.
How often do you get back to your home state of North Dakota to perform now that you have made quite a name for yourself? NPR calls you one of the most arresting voices in folk music today.
Well, I get back quite a bit for visits. All of my family live in North Dakota, up in Drayton and Grand Forks and Northwood. So I just, it's actually one of my favorite things to do is to come back and have visits and stay. And every once in a while, I get to play when I come back for a visit, which is just as nice.
And you're coming up to one of those visits in late August into September. You'll be performing at Medora, the Great American Folk Show at the Old Town Hall. And you'll have special guests Gregory Page and Misty Koop. Describe the show.
Well, the show sort of spawned from a show that I'd done with Gregory Page, who's a good friend of mine from San Diego, California. We both share the love of American folk music, and we created a duo called the American Folk Singers. And we went around and played at old folks' homes, and we sure had a good time. And so we both thought maybe, you know, one day this would be a great thing to do, to bring to a theater. And, it took a couple of years, but by golly, I've done it, and we're debuting in Medora at the Old Town Hall. I'm really excited about that, too.
And tickets are real reasonable, $14. The shows are at 1:30 in the afternoon, so bring the family. Yeah.
Yes, an all-ages event, and the idea behind it is to uncover some of those great American folk songs that people know or didn't know that they knew.
The shows are August 27th to September 6th. How often is a tour stop like that kind of in your path? I mean, normally a concert's one night, maybe two nights if it's a major city. This is almost like a residency.
That's a good way to put it. It is like a residency. Typically, summer touring is it's a lot of fun, but for a musician on the tier that I'm on, it's not the easiest thing to do, so I welcome it. I'm really glad, actually, to be in one place for a certain number of days. Otherwise, it can get a bit wearisome traveling all the time.
Well, a couple of days before you appear in Medora, your new album will be released. It's titled Treasures Untold. What does the title mean to you?
Well, the title kind of sums up everything that I love about American folk music, and it's Treasures Untold was originally a Jimmy Rogers song, and I'm just a big fan of Jimmy Rogers. I know quite a few of his songs, and the album itself is a live album, and I do sing a version of Treasures Untold, and when I was thinking about what would make a great album cover for this project, it just was staring at me right in the face, Treasures Untold.
Well, Jimmy Rogers yodels in the song. Do you yodel?
I do. I'm not the best yodeler, however. Whenever I yodel, my cat meows. there's something that cats love about my yodel. But I do yodel on one of the other Jimmy Rogers songs that I cover on the record, a song called Dreaming with Tears in My Eyes. Just a really lovely song. Jimmy Rogers was a great songwriter.
Well, we should hear that, Dreaming with Tears in My Eyes. You want to set us up? What is this song about?
Well, it's a somewhat of a rare Jimmy Rogers song. It was a part of his last sessions that he had recorded. And you can tell that his health is failing. If you listen to the Jimmy Rogers catalog, you know when you come to this song that he kind of has that rattle happening. And it's just a lovely song. I just really love it, and I hope everyone else will too.
My heart is longing for you, dear. I cared for you more than you knew. Though you have broken his promise, and yesterday's dreams are untrue. Alone I'll be yearning tomorrow, when sunshine brings memories of you. My sunshine will turn into sorrow, as I dream of the love we once knew. Why should I always be lonely when sunny and blue are the skies? While shadows of loneliness linger, I'm dreaming with tears in my eyes.
Well, that's beautiful, Tom, and it's very simple. It's you and a guitar.
Just me and a guitar. It's an aspect of folk music that I love so much. It comes down to a voice of any talent and really guitar ability of any talent. It doesn't take much. All it takes is for a little feeling.
There are 10 songs on the album, 6 from what's called the Great American Folk Songbook and 4 originals. What do you like about each, writing your own work, performing your own work, and doing a cover of somebody else's song?
Well, my own songs, I'll just say that it's kind of like a tick that I have. I hear something that somebody says, or I have an idea, and I've just got to follow it. It's like almost like being a detective. I need to know where it all will lead. That, in a nutshell, kind of explains my songwriting process. And and the songs that I love to sing and I love to record, they have this quality about it. I've been thinking about it a long time now. It's like an everyman quality, an everyday quality. It's like it's the voice of humanity, and I need to hear that voice, and I need to sing those songs.
What comes first, the theme of the song, the melody, the lyrics?
It's a good question, and I think every songwriter's writing process differs. But for me, probably the idea, and then as I get going, the idea will reveal certain feelings that then will, you know, inform me on where to go musically on the guitar.
Who is your best collaborative partner? Do you have one, or do you tend to work best solo?
I think I tend to work best solo, but I've been learning a lot from working with Sean Watkins, a friend of mine from Southern California. The two of us have recorded a couple of records together of mine, one entitled Grass Punks and also a release that came last year entitled North Dakota Impressions. And Sean is just an excellent songwriter, one heck of a guitar player, and I've learned a lot from just hanging around him. You know, that's the great thing about being in the arts is you don't necessarily need to study in any one particular method. I think really what counts is that you surround yourself with great people.
Well, he performed with you in your Tiny Desk concert at NPR. Again, I recommend people search that out because it's fun to watch and listen to.
That was a blast, being on that program with Sean Watkins. Yeah, as you can see, if people do look up that particular Tiny Desk performance, you'll know how much Sean Watkins is carrying me.
Has your approach to creating an album changed over the years? I mean, there's technology has changed. Listening behaviors might have altered. I don't know. What's the formula for you?
It has changed. I just think I've come to really understand that I don't know as much as I thought I used to. I think I was more confident back when I was first starting to record, but the process really hasn't changed. All you need is something to record and a mic. That's really all you need, and for the most part, that's how my records still go. I don't get into the studio, the traditional studio. I record at home in a garage, anywhere I can find an open space.
And people can listen to it and find out more at tombrosseau.com. That's Brosseau is Brosseau. And when you have your records up there, you promote them, of course. You offer it in vinyl as well.
That's a big thing today, I got to tell you. Vinyl has come back in a big and bad way. And it's great, you know, because it's something physical. And I think people really love that about music. It's what people miss most is actually having a physical form right there in your hand. As a performer, though, I got to tell you, it really kind of starts to weigh you down. I think I can only bring about 30 copies with me before my backpack gets too heavy.
Yes, you brag about how heavy the vinyl is.
Yeah, heavy.
Hi, you are living in Salt Lake City now. You met a woman, you married, you're living there. How do you describe the music scene in Salt Lake?
I've just been branching out and finding those little pockets. My wife likes to go contra dancing, so we've done that a few times, and I find that activity, it goes just perfectly well with folk songs. So I hear just about the same folk songs wherever I go here in Utah, and I love it. And it's just simple instrumentation, you know, the acoustic guitar, the upright bass, the mandolin, and the singing. And it's so much fun, you know. It just is so much fun.
A couple of years ago on this show, we featured an excerpt from an interview you did with Scott Simon at NPR. And at that point, you were talking briefly about a feature film, a short you'd done called Wonder Valley. Done any acting since?
No acting since, no, but I do enjoy it, I must say. I really do enjoy it. People have asked me who have seen that particular short, and they've asked me if I plan to get into acting, and I don't, but I love acting. And maybe that's one of the ways that I love performing so much is I feel like when I step out on the stage, I'm kind of acting too, and I get to be this character that I've been developing for a number of years. I really enjoy it.
You have a set of albums, North Dakota Impressions, Perfect Abandon, and Grass Punks, and these are sort of informally known as the North Dakota Trilogy. What does that mean?
Well, at the time, that I began writing this particular project. I didn't really know what it was that I was after. I think only until I was finished did I realize that there was some common themes that was happening here. And I was thinking a lot about where I came from and some of the little stories and the local, the sense of being local and identity. That's what I mean, I think, when I say North Dakota Trilogy. It all kind of goes back to the same place.
And your new album features actually a couple of monologues on it. You recorded it in Cologne, Germany, so you talk about Cologne. You also talk about Jimmy Rogers.
Yeah. It's very, very much how I would run my regular live programs. I keep it loosey-goosey, so to speak. I never know what I'm going to play. I have maybe an idea of what I would like to do, but I, for the most part, I just feel the room out, and so that sometimes means that I'm going to talk. In fact, one time I was talking way too much, and somebody from the audience said, where's the music?
Well, the music's going to be in Medora late in August, and Tom Brousseau will be playing it. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
More information at tombrousseau.com. Coming up on Main Street, an essay from Tom Eason and Natural North Dakota after that.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
The new season of Prairie Musicians highlights the Max Jonk Group, a jazz quartet from the Fargo-Moorhead area. Then later, the Concordia College Marimba Choir will strut their talents with a range of works from classical to ragtime.
Friday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, on the television service of Prairie Public.
Beware the Plant in Little Shop of Horrors, presented outdoors under the stars at Sleepy Hollow Arts Park in Bismarck. 8 p.m. shows are August 2nd through the 6th and the 8th through the 10th. Tickets available at most Subways, Eckroth Music, Direct Travel, Satrum Travel, or at the gates. Reserved seats are available, or you can bring your own chair or blanket. More information can be found online at shtap.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Eason is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and the author of the Plains Folk Essays. Today's essay looks at the beauty of our state, and it's titled The Prairie Garden.
Our property is host this summer to a family of serial killers. A Cooper's hawk raised a clutch of little Coopers in an ash tree overlooking our garden and supervised their hunting lessons in the willows on the creek. Now we have hawks continually wheeling through, seeking targets of opportunity. This makes songbirds less numerous around the place than usual. Gophers and rabbits, previously legion, now are scarce. On the brighter side, we haven't had to net the berry bushes this year. Early this morning, I walked out to the garden to check a sprinkler, and there was one of those hawklets bathing himself, perched on the edge of a raised bed, spreading his wings to catch droplets, doing a little dance of delight, courtesy of Cass County Rural Water. So now I'm inclined to forgive his murderous brood the shredded carcasses we have found on the property all summer. Which brings me to the question. What's a prairie garden for, anyway? In the modern situation, it cannot be for basic nutrition. We would do just fine as to produce with the retail and local markets. Of course, we have some eccentric tastes that have to be served from our own production, ground cherries, for instance, or herbs like tarragon and lovage, but there are plenty of other eccentric notions available for purchase. I can think of three good reasons, though, for husbanding a prairie garden, all of them contributing to the idea of the good life on the Great Plains. First, seasonality. There's a complex order to garden transactions that is conducive to human comfort. Right now is a cluttered time on the calendar, as the cherries, raspberries, juneberries, gooseberries, and currants all demand harvest and processing. And when the root crops come out of the garden in tubs, man, that just defines a prairie autumn. Second, culture. Thoughtful gardening is interlaced with cultural traditions and human relationships. My Egyptian onions trace their lineage to my late mother's garden in western Kansas. My horseradish came from a sweet upland farm woman in the Flint Hills. My hyssop is a recent acquisition from a good friend who keeps a sprawling garden along the Red River, who in turn captured it from the wild. The process and use of garden produce, too, perpetuates tradition. Canning lore and family recipes are called into action. Right now, I'm eyeing the green beans, anticipating a skillet of beans and nephila with butter and savory. And third, there is the nature thing. Right now, I'm in touch with my hawks, but also with the frogs and toads that invest my moist space in a dry summer. I cuss the perennial weeds and then the annuals, but might miss them if they were gone. I bring captives in from the wild, wild asparagus, Maximilian sunflowers, field mint, native columbine, and corrupt them with the comforts of domesticity. I hope the wood ducks come back this fall to get drunk again on crab apples. Sometimes, I confess, I walk Angie the history dog out to the garden and we sit and have a talk, she and I and the plants. Perhaps I'm hearing things. How fortunate that I can.
That's Tom Easern. Incidentally, tomorrow on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith will join us to talk about lawns and gardens. Coming up next, Natural North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Prairie Roots Food Co-op, focused on sustainable agriculture and locally grown products. A grocery store and deli in downtown Fargo, now open on the corner of MP Avenue and University Drive, and online at prairieroots.coop.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Chuck Lura teaches biology at Dakota College at Botineau, and he's another of Main Street's regular essayists. You can find his work online by searching for Natural North Dakota. Today, he's talking about molting waterfowl.
Not long ago, I was seeing ducks on most every marsh. Lots of ducks. As of late, though, it seems like they've all vanished. They haven't vanished, of course, and they haven't likely headed south. They're probably molting. Most birds replace their feathers one at a time. That way their ability to fly throughout the year is not significantly impaired. That's not the case with waterfowl. They lose all their flight feathers at the same time. Ornithologists call it synchronous molting. And during this time they cannot fly, and as a result are more vulnerable to predation. So they head for cover while they molt. That basically means they stay in amongst tall emergent wetland plants such as cattails and bulrushes until they regain their ability to fly. The timing of this molt in waterfowl varies by species as well as individuals within a species. So if you're watching waterfowl during the summer, you may see a few ducks overhead throughout the summer, but around July and August, there just aren't many ducks visible in the air or on the water. Ducks will select certain wetlands in which to molt. It might be a wetland near where they spent much of their summer. Some species, however, may migrate great distances to a molting wetland. Either way, these wetlands generally have some open water, but also lots of emergent vegetation, such as cattails or bulrushes, which provide the all-important cover for the birds while they molt. Biologists have found that an open water to emergent vegetation ratio between 50-50 and 70-30 are best. Not only is the cover a key factor in these wetlands, but replacing all those feathers is an energy-expensive process. And because feathers are largely protein, the duck diet needs to be high in protein. So these wetlands generally support abundant populations of invertebrates in addition to the emergent vegetation. So as you travel about, make a point of making some mental notes as to the waterfowl in your area this time of year compared to earlier in the season. And of course, it won't be long before the molt is complete, and those new feathers will get a real workout as the fall migration commences. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-7255. 6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 25th. On this date in 2003, a small church in St. Lambert, Quebec, celebrated its 150th year. To mark the occasion, the congregation dedicated a plaque to the Colette family, which donated land for the church in 1850. It is believed the first Colettes arrived on the North American continent from France around the mid-1700s. They spread out through the communities of St. Lambert, St. Isidore, and St. Henri-Lévis in Quebec. They stayed in this area for about 100 years before Colettes were on the move again, locating in St. Anthony, Minnesota in 1865. It's speculated that they moved because available farmland in St. Lambert had become scarce. A close relative, Sam Colette, had moved to the St. Anthony area 3 years prior. However, their stay in Minnesota proved temporary. In 1877, the railroad from Minneapolis to Winnipeg was completed, helping open the region to settlers. In 1878, four Colette brothers hopped on this new opportunity and headed north to homestead in Dakota Territory. While there is no record of their travels, it is likely they took the railroad as far as possible, then traveled on foot, trusting that the promise of land would be worth the trek. As it turned out, they established deep roots and large families. The tiny town of Oakwood in North Dakota became a hub for the French-Canadian family, attracting additional family members. However, this growth did not come without struggle. When the first Colettes moved in 1878, the prairie was still considered undesirable. Crops had to be hauled 30 to 40 miles overland to be sold, and during the winter they were shut off from the outside world. However, determined people like the Colettes forged the way, and within years, the prairie was better populated, providing more mutual support. Today, the Colettes have spread across the continent, living as far south as Florida and as far north as Montreal. While they may have started in France and have since spread beyond North Dakota, it can be argued that their strongest roots remain in Oakwood. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Lafayette Gilchrist remembers the day that news of Freddie Gray spread through his city of Baltimore.
It was bad. It was as bad as I've ever seen. No words to describe, really, the feeling of that day.
So he wrote a song, Blues for Freddie Gray. Also the latest news on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, we'll talk with Leanne Birch, the director of North Dakota's prison system. Birch is adopting some of the strategies she observed in Norwegian prisons, and her efforts are profiled in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. And horticulturist Ron Smith will answer midsummer lawn and garden questions and offer tips for dealing with severe drought. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.